WAI, Honolulu, 1080 on the AM dial.
America is essentially a dream. It is a dream of a land where men of all races, of all nationalities, and of all creeds can live together as brothers. The substance of the dream is expressed in these profound words. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. One of the first things we notice in this dream is its amazing universalism. It does not say some men, but it says all men. It doesn't say all white men, but it says all men, which includes black men. It doesn't say all Gentiles, but it says all men, which includes Jews. It doesn't say all Protestants, but it says all men, which includes Catholics. That is something else that we notice in this dream, which is one of the things that distinguishes democracy and our form of government with other totalitarian systems. It says that there are certain basic rights that are neither conferred by nor derived from the state. In order to discover where they came from, it is necessary to move back behind the dim mist of eternity. They are God-given. Very seldom. Very seldom, if ever, in the history of the world has a socio-political document expressed in such profound, eloquent, and unequivocal language the dignity and the worth of human personality. For the American dream reminds us that every man is the heir of a legacy of dignity. And yet ever since the founding fathers of our nation dreamed this dream, America has been, to use a big word that the psychologists and the psychiatrists use, a schizophrenic personality. On the one hand, she has proudly professed the noble principles of democracy, and on the other hand, she has sadly practiced the very opposite of those principles. Indeed, slavery and segregation have always been strange paradoxes in a nation founded on the principle that all men are created equal. So often, America has trampled over the dream. So often, America has scarred this noble dream. We look and see certain states saying they will never comply with the law of the land. In doing this, America is scarring the dream. We notice people who merely want to be free being brutalized, homes being bombed, churches being bombed. This is a way of scarring the American dream. We notice people who merely want to exercise their citizenship rights being thrown into jail. This is a way of scarring the dream. And we can hear the voice of a little Emmett Till crying from the rushing waters of Mississippi. This is a way of scarring the dream. And so the Negro is still trampled over by the iron feet of oppression. And so often he has been pushed out of the glittering sunlight of life's July and left standing in the piercing chill of an alpine November. This is scarring the American dream. May I say to you, as has been said so eloquently all the afternoon, this dream is being scarred not only in Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana and all of the southern states, but it is being scarred in New York and Illinois, in Pennsylvania, and I imagine even in California. The fact is that the Negro all over America is still the last hired and the first fired, and he still can't live where he wants to live and where his money can get him to live. But today, more than ever before, America is challenged to bring this noble dream into reality. For the shape of the world today does not afford us the luxury of an anemic democracy. And the price that the United States must pay for the continued exploitation of the Negro and other minority groups is the price of its own destruction. People are looking over to the United States today and they're wondering what we are doing about this problem. They're looking over from Asia and Africa. For years, most of these people have been dominated politically, exploited economically, segregated and humiliated by some foreign power. But today they are gaining their independence. More than 1,600,000,000 of the former 1,800,000,000 colonial subjects have their independence today, and they are saying in no uncertain terms that racism and colonialism must go. The hour is late, and the clock of destiny is ticking out, and we must act now before it is too late. It is trite but urgently true that if America is to remain a first-class nation, she can no longer have second-class citizens. Now, I must hasten to say that we must not solve this problem merely to meet the communist challenge. We must not seek to solve this problem merely to appeal to Asian and African peoples. This problem must be solved in the United States because segregation and discrimination are morally wrong.
If you have questions or comments for Carol, our number here is 524-1080, 524-1080. And now, here's Carol. The program is brought to you by Carol Cox. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of KWAI staff and management.
And good morning and welcome to the Carol Cox Show. As you may take a note there, that was the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. And if you haven't gathered by now or guessed by now, he's one of my favorite people. In fact, I look up to him, have always, and not because of my experiences, but everything that he said yesterday is appropriate today, in my opinion. And I was just on the Big Island, and I see here in a country of, that should be called Hawaii, we call it a state, I'm noticing fewer native people and more foreigners and people that are imported and have migrated here and put up their major fences and gates and walls to keep, I guess, the gargoyles out there, because clearly they wouldn't do this for the to keep people out, people that really own it. But really, it's a sad commentary that, and it's unfolding while we all pretend to be in this beautiful land of host culture and what have you. And when you see gates go up on lands, we talk about subsistence. When you see gates go up and block off the entire mountain area for gathering, then that's not much of any hosting going on. So anyway, in that spirit, I'm fortunate this morning, and I believe you'll take away with this and believe that you were fortunate too. I have Massachusetts State Representative Byron Rushing here with me, and also Marsha John is joining us. So this is really exciting to have him, Mr. Rushing, involved in having, willing to come in and talk with us, because no matter where we are within these United States or globally now, the world faces these problems, and it's nice and calming to know that, almost reassured, that someone in government is really reaching out to take on these issues, such as homelessness, people with HIV or AIDS, or just purchasing of homes and all of those things. And we're going to talk to Mr. Rushing about that, or State Representative Rushing. And if you want to call in and have any questions, please feel free. And then the later hour, we're going to talk about HUD and that affordable housing, but you'll see the relationship. So without any delay now, I will introduce Mr. Rushing and welcome you aboard, sir.
Thank you very much, Carol. It's really a privilege to be here. This is, before you say it, let me say it, aloha, and this is my first trip to Hawaii.
Okay.
So I've only been here for 2 days, I think, and to be on your radio show in that time, I just feel privileged.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's we know it's Martin Luther King's, I'll call it the week or the birthday, because even though it's his birthday nearing, we take advantage of that and try to remind people. And because the struggle is not over, not just for African American, but for people nowadays, as it has always been. But we were, me in the Delta of Mississippi, I was reminded daily that I need to do something and learn something to fight this hatred and the racisms and the inequities. So, and you are, just looking at your background, this, you sponsored legislation to create the Commission to Develop Comprehensive Plan in Homelessness in the Commonwealth. How did you do that? And any pointers or any information you could share with us?
I'd be happy to talk about all of that. Let me say first, though, that Martin Luther King, this day, this and these days, I think have become more and more significant. I have to tell you, I don't know where you were on the birthday, but when the birthday was first proposed, I was not in favor of it.
Mm-hmm.
I was not in favor of the birthday because I thought that that would actually prevent people from talking about the reality of Martin Luther King, because I did not know of any holiday in the United States to commemorate a person as radical as Martin Luther King. And so I thought that, that it would really water down. It would get people to not look at all the things that he has done. And I think that it actually started that way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and it took a few years before we were able to convince most Americans that Martin Luther King made more than one speech.
You know what I mean?
Right. But I do think, and I've changed my mind about the day as a holiday, but I do think that enough people who understand the importance of human rights in the world, civil rights in this country, have found ways of using this time so that we can have some honest conversations about what we need to be doing going into the future. I'll say one thing about the March on Washington. I was in the civil rights movement. I worked for an organization called CORE, and one important thing, CORE stood for Congress of Racial Equality. And one of the things that we always have to tell young people is that the civil rights movement had more than one leader, and the civil rights movement had more than one organization. And so all of those organizations were working, and in any movement, you had the more moderate members and the more radical people in that in that movement. And so there was a lot of opposition inside the movement to having the march, because they thought that the march was going to be, in order to get all of those people together, you were not going to be able to say some of the things that were happening in the country.
Right.
And of course, we know the whole famous story about how the leaders of the march went to the then spokesman for the Southern, for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
SNCC.
There's SNCC over there. And asked him and said, you have to make some changes to your speech. So we knew about all of that kind of stuff. So it's important to put all of this in that context. But it is interesting that Martin Luther King, on that day, understood that he had to actually move away from what he originally wanted to speak to. You know, and the pieces, right, and we have to remember that the pieces of the speech that get quoted the most are the speeches that he ad-libbed, not the pieces that were written.
Yeah, if you read the written speech, it's not there. But I Have a Dream, it's not there.
Yeah. Well, when I grew up, same time, I'm 60, I'll be 61 this year, and there was always a debate that Dr. King was radical. His comments were radical. And we concluded amongst our community, and I grew up around Fannie Lou Hamer and the co-op and there in Ruval, we felt that it would be inaccurate to bother with describing his actions, because what was really going on, what was provoking, what was prompting him and other leaders, young black men would be easily lynched. You can't get any more radical than that. Those actions, your houses being burned, your churches being bombed, you know, Emmett Till and the civil rights people, and just people being murdered, African Americans being murdered at the hands of whites. So we used to say then, words are described as being radical when the actual action that's provoking you, or prompting or prodding you, they're pale in comparison.
Right.
And so that's how we dealt with it. And any radical speech was something, was a bit of assurance that something was going to change. Because I've tried to be diplomatic on many occasions, but sometimes when you're diplomatic, the people that were going to support you are not moved. They want to hear the fire in your belly, because they then hear that, gee, it must be painful. I hear the hurt. So.
And of course, Martin Luther King was in all of his career was growing. Right? You know, I mean, the things that he said in the early 60s were very different than the way he put things in the 50s. And then, of course, when he realized that, but from his point of view, people were not hearing him. In terms of the implications of what he was saying for the way the whole country had to change,
right.
He had to get more explicit, and he certainly got more explicit about the whole issue of peace, of ending war, And, of course, when he was talking about ending war, he was not talking in general terms. That was not a generalization. He was talking about a war that we were engaged in Vietnam.
Right.
And after that, of course, many of the places, many of the organizations, many of the and parts of the media, right, that had been supporting him, right, just left him. They just threw him under, literally threw him under the bus.
Yeah.
New York Times has this wonderful editorial after he gave his speech, the first public speech that he gave around the whole issue of Vietnam was actually in the South at his church, right? Got very little coverage. And then he had gave essentially the same speech up at Riverside Church in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And that got the reaction. And the New York Times the next day denounced him in their in the editorial page.
Mm-hmm. He got the traction. But isn't that the nature of advocacy?
It is absolutely. But I guess I go back to my point, what I'm finding is more and more people are ready now to talk about that part.
Well, and there was one other thing, because, you know, we hear this one speech, we hear these, out of 18 minutes, we hear four lines. And that the last speech he gave, the very last, if you listen to it, it's on, and everybody should listen to the whole thing. It's on YouTube, it's free. Mm-hmm. So in the long speech, well, everybody knows I've been to the mountaintop, right? You know that.
Oh, yeah.
You know that part. Mm-hmm. I've been to the mountaintop. You know, and about longevity,
right.
And everybody says, oh, he knew. Well, but if you listen to the whole speech, and anybody that wants to, it 22.8 minutes into the speech, I want you to listen. He talks about economic withdrawal,
right.
And the amount of finances and economics that we, as black people, control. And he spells it out, his economic plan. And then he goes on to say, if you withdraw your money from Coca-Cola, Wonder Bread, he spells out all of these companies where we should withdraw our money. And what happened the next day? He's dead.
Mm-hmm.
The papers, and they do not show you that part of the speech. All they have edited, so all you hear is, I've been to the mountaintop.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that, so one of the things that I would say to people about Martin Luther King's birthday is something I tell people about Black History Month. I mean, I think what is most important about this is this day and this weekend is to commit yourself to studying the work of Martin Luther King and the whole movement that he came out of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like I always remind people about Black History Month, people say, how come when you and I were growing up, we only had a week,
right?
But one of the things about Black History Week and Black History Month is that it was never designed to be the time where you learned it. It was designed to be the time when you showed off what you knew about it.
Right.
You learned it all year round, and then this is the time that all the kids when Black History Month was created, were in mostly segregated schools.
Mm-hmm.
That was when the kids then were able to say and write their papers and have their contests and tell what they had learned.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to use Martin Luther King's birthday that way.
Mm-hmm.
We have to work on this all year round,
mm-hmm.
and then talk about, we should get together and talk about, now what did we do last year, right? In the spirit he was teaching us.
Speaking of year-round, one of the things that we have statewide is the Martin Luther King Poetry Contest. And all of the schools, public and private schools, are invited to participate. And then the first year we did it, we had 300 statewide. Last year we had 1,200 winners statewide,
mm-hmm.
because they compete at their own level. So you don't have kindergartners competing with fifth graders or 12th graders or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So we have grown, and it's statewide. So that, and it happens in April and May,
mm-hmm.
not in Black History Month. So it, because it takes time to develop.
Well, I always gravitate back to the as we're talking about, temper your comments and say the in a kind way or rephrase it. We're struggling through this horrendous time and this whole effort evolving out of slavery, which we should never have been in, and we have that to deal with. And so he did, in fact, modify the tone, temper the tone. And the last thing he heard was a shot. Bow. Mm-hmm. So it goes to show you, you never, ever, when you're in a struggle, when someone is depriving an entire people, not just African Americans, but people, demoralizing them and enslaving them and what have you, sometimes you should be able to stand up and scream in the worst way there is, because nothing is equivalent to the behavior that prompts you or motivate you to want to scream.
Right.
Nothing. And those, I'm hoping that one day there's been an apology, for example, here in Hawaii, you know, Bill Clinton gave an apology. But the apology, as one gentleman said, you stole my bicycle. I remind you that it's my bicycle. You apologize, but you keep the bicycle.
That's right.
And this is what's going on today. We look around us. We got the minimum wage. I was making more per day chopping cotton when economically, as on a scale compared to today's value of the dollar, than a person standing at McDonald's or anywhere else making minimum wage.
And I think Marsha bringing up the speech in Memphis is a good segue into, of course, what the kinds of work that I've been trying to do in Massachusetts. Because the issue that brought him to Memphis was a labor issue.
Labor, trash men.
It was trash collectors,
right,
who were all black, all African American in that city.
Mm-hmm.
And the strike that they were engaged in, right, with the city over not only salary but working conditions.
Right.
They did not have any showers in their workplace.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They had, so they'd be finished and then have to go home.
Mm-hmm.
Right, before they could get cleaned up. And so there were, and he was there to defend that they were not being discriminated against in the technical term of racial discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
But they were being discriminated against because they were poor. They were being discriminated against because they were working class and were not allowed the rights that they should have. And of course, if he had lived, the next where he was heading to was for his whole demonstration around ending poverty in the country, that he realized that poverty was not ending, and you had all the plans were in place for the Poor People's March, which did occur after he died.
Mm-hmm.
But I think so when we talk about freedom from the point of view of the civil rights movement, we're talking about freedom for everybody.
Right.
And when we talk about freedom, we're talking about people being able to live and work and play to their ability.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing should stop them except their ability.
Mm-hmm.
And that is opportunity.
Now,
and we're talking about that for everybody.
Now, speaking of ability, I note that you, in Massachusetts, you actually champion a cause of over-the-counter sterile needle program. I want to talk about Dr. King, but I also want to talk about what's currently going on. I mean, first of all, how do you bring yourself as a state representative to look backwards toward the people that needed to help control? And, you know, in this world of a war against crime, drugs, war on drugs, and all of this, and you, in your position, dared to introduce or, you know, approach.
Right, we're on radio, so only you can see me smiling.
I mean, that's it.
But it is an interest. I think that one of the things that I learned from being in the civil rights movement, what I learned from being in the civil rights movement was that what was remarkable, what you could understand as oppression,
is when you ask people to do something that seems to be common sense, mm-hmm. and they put you in jail.
Right.
And so here we have a problem that that gets presented to us by the public health authorities,
mm-hmm.
and they say that we have this amazing rate of transmission of AIDS in the black community.
Right.
And this is from Massachusetts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, and we know that one of the reasons for this transmission is sexual activity.
Right.
But we also know that one of the reasons for this transmission is that there's blood being transferred because of IV drug users. Right? So we have IV drug users, and they are transmitting mm-hmm. this disease.
Mm-hmm.
What we say to the people around sexual relations is use condoms.
Right.
What we say to the people who use who are addicts and who use needles is, sorry, we can't help you.
Mm-hmm.
No, why don't we give these people make sure they have clean needles?
Because they were sharing needles.
Mm-hmm. And the reason why we can't give them clean needles is because you actually have to have a prescription to go get a needle.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So for the people who are taking drugs intravenously, right, and taking medical drugs reasons intravenously.
Right.
And we say, well, let's be able to let this group of people have it so that they can at least live. And people say, well, this will be terrible, because it will make for more addicts, it will make drugs more available. And I said, no, we have to talk about addiction separate from the transmission of
mm-hmm.
this disease.
Mm-hmm.
We need to end addiction. Right? But we can't end addiction if all the addicts are dead.
Right.
Right. So we have to be willing to we'll shift how we approach addicts. Right. We will treat them as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And if you treat them as human beings, then you say, okay, we can make a simple adjustment, like making needles, sterile needles, available over the counter
mm-hmm.
rather than by a prescription.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an argument. We had people who were doing work with addicts who were opposed to what we were asking.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't find any addicts who were opposed to what we were asking.
But
and when we made it available, they went out and used it. Right? They went out and found those sterile needles.
To pursue something like this, then it suggests to me that you think community rather than one element of it. You're thinking about the whole of the community, because drug issue is drug issue. It's always there. And to be so daring to say, well, I'm going to facilitate you in, that's the way some looked at it.
That's right.
I'm going to facilitate you in committing an unlawful act, and that is using an illicit drug, when in fact you had a bigger concern of health to us all and welfare.
And I learned mm-hmm. in the movement,
mm-hmm.
right, that I had to treat these people as human beings first.
Mm-hmm.
And we say that, but it's work. To
right.
treat everybody as a human being first, and then start talking about what they look like.
Mm-hmm.
But first, they are a human being, and let's deal with and respect them, right? And listen to them, right? As human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can talk about all the differences. We can get into that. But you can't start with the differences and try to move toward the humanity. You have
mm-hmm.
to start with the humanity. And then consider the differences.
So it appears that
now, and
go ahead.
And you have to be willing to have the arguments. You do have to have the argument. I'm a legislator.
Mm-hmm.
In the Massachusetts legislature, we have like you, two houses, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we have a Senate that's made up of 40 people, and we have a House of Representatives that I'm a member of that's made up of 160 people. And I tell my constituents all the time, I can get them anything they want. Just ask me, I'll get it for you. Now, I only have one thing I have to do. We have 160 state representatives. 81 is a majority. I got to get 80 other state representatives to agree with me, and I can get you anything you want.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
I also have to get the senators to agree with me, and then even at the bottom line, I have to get the governor to agree with me. But so all of this is to say that this is all cooperative. I mean, you can't do this without being able to talk, you know, sometimes quietly, sometimes not quietly, to your colleagues about getting them on board.
Now, I don't want to diminish your stature, but we would call that mojo. You seem to have mojo working. because I go and just take one more step forward, and I look, you're engaged in the homeless. You've done proactive work in combating homeless issues. And simply because here, for example, when we discuss homelessness on the show, occasionally someone says, well, those people are just lazy and all of these things. And the reality is it's still about the community. It's still about, it's equivalent of the drug issues. The drugs are out there regardless. What do we do? So you seem to tackle that issue too. So
I think again, right, you literally have to go talk to the people who are homeless.
Right.
You got to start there. Now, you know, you can talk to the people who work with the homeless, right? Mm-hmm. You can talk with the people who do all of that great work, you know. But you got to talk to the homeless. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and when I was growing up, this is before the civil rights movement, when I was growing up, you know, you'd ask a person, how come you're poor, right? And they wouldn't say, I'm poor because I have these psychological problems, or they would say, I'm poor. I wouldn't even say I'm poor. Mm-hmm. They would say, I'm poor because I ain't got no money.
Right.
That's why I'm poor. Mm-hmm. Right. And so you ask most people who are homeless, how come you're homeless? They say, I'm homeless because I don't have a house.
Right.
I don't have a roof over my head on a regular basis. That's right. So we in Massachusetts said, look, we're spending a lot of money on shelters. Right. But shelters can't be the solution. What is the solution? The solution has to be housing. And so we made a decision that we would make a major shift. Okay. We called it, in Massachusetts, we called it housing first.
Okay.
That before any other services, right, services should be available to these people. But the primary service, the thing that we work on first for everyone, mm-hmm. should be trying to get them a home, trying to get them someplace. It might be a room for single men. It might be a way to have permanent housing where families are living together and sharing some things in that, or it might just be straight out subsidized housing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But we will find a way to get people housing. Now, we made that shift when we were feeling pretty good in terms of the economy. And about 6 months after, we made that announcement. Mm-hmm. For this significant policy shift that everybody agreed to. The governor adopted it as his housing policy for Massachusetts. We had the big depression. We had our depression. We are now, we
Is
try
that
to call
Deval them, Patrick?
Right. Deval Patrick, who was our governor.
Mm-hmm.
And the only, right now, African-American governor in the United States. And so what we thought we were going to be able to do in a relatively short time, maybe 5 to 7 years, is going to take us a lot longer. But we haven't changed the policy. And so that's where we are concentrating. We are concentrating on getting people housing first.
Well, you know, I look at this, and I've always questioned, just locally here, and I don't want, this is not an indictment, I don't want you to participate in this statement, but I've always felt that once one goes inside of government and leadership or legislative roles, they tend to abandon. It's the real fight for the people, what brought them, that most of them say in their speeches while beating the campaign trail, I'm going to get in so that we can fight poverty, so we can fight homelessness, so we can fight drugs and do all of that and build education and we're going to take domestic violence and we're going to stamp it out. And they get in and completely 360 turnaround in a sense, and most of them. Legislative, they introduce bills and those bills just die on the vine. But I look at you. what is it about you that allow you to become a be elected, and then still adhere to what? Because I did a little more Googling on you, and I'm saying to myself, is he real? because not only are you actively introducing and fighting for these to get them passed, you're out there talking about it and looking for more things to be introduced. Where do you get it from?
Well, I keep going back. You know, I guess if I ran all the way back, I'd go back to my mama, who taught me to respect people. But it's certainly the civil rights movement, and being a community organizer after the civil rights movement has a big effect on it. And it has to do with as I said, you know, approaching people as a human beings. But I also, I expect people to be calling me up and trying to get me I expect people to push me.
Mm-hmm.
See, I tell people, you know, I mean, you know, we can get this done, you know, but it'd be a lot, we could get this done a lot faster if we had a big advocacy group working on this too.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I like to work with people pushing me. Right? So I like to be connected to advocacy groups.
Mm-hmm. And then the violence issue. Go ahead.
Yeah, so something like the needles and the needle exchange. Sometimes the advocates of drug addicts coming up to the state house and
right.
You know, are not necessarily the best. They're not necessarily the best advocates for themselves.
Yeah,
right. You know, but many times what you have to do is to make sure that that the advocates have to be out there working.
Yeah.
On this kind of stuff, so I'll tell the drug addicts, you know, I will cover, you know, I will do this for you,
mm-hmm.
But also that means that you have to go talk to your friends
mm-hmm.
out there and say, you know, if this happens, we're going to actually do this. We're not going to fool around about how we are actually going to change the culture of taking our drug,
mm-hmm.
and that's what because we were asking them to make a big change themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and they of course did that.
Mm-hmm.
Say on another issue, which you just have finished here in Hawaii on same sex marriage.
Yeah, I was going to get
on same sex marriage. We had that was a question of advocates for same sex marriage deciding to just do all of the necessary work that they had to do that. And there was going to be no way that we were going to be able to get same-sex marriage, convince my colleagues about same-sex marriage just by having a group of legislators who thought it made sense
mm-hmm.
to go try to get them to think. They needed to hear, all those legislators in Massachusetts needed to hear from their own constituents.
Mm-hmm.
They needed to hear from the people in their districts who said, This is something that makes sense, and this is the time to do it.
Now, I got two questions, and one's going to be a little sensitive in a sense, but you can shine some light on it. But you really went out and introduced the bill. You were one of the parties that introduced it. Why did you feel that such a bill need to be introduced, and what came to enlighten you or to say that you should introduce and support a bill? What were
is
the things?
Is this the bill for the same-sex marriage? Okay.
Right. So what happened in Massachusetts is, just to get the chronology right, that's
mm-hmm.
true. We introduced a bill on same-sex marriage, but on a parallel route, the advocates were suing on same-sex marriage, and that happened first. So they won the suit.
Mm-hmm.
So our Supreme Court, state Supreme Court, ruled that same-sex marriage was constitutional, and by our state constitution,
mm-hmm.
and so then our bill, the issue was not our bill anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The issue became people wanted to change the constitution. So the big fight that we had in Massachusetts was all of the people who did not support same-sex marriage wanted to put an amendment in the state constitution saying it would be illegal.
Mm-hmm.
So for the next three years we fought to keep that amendment from happening, and then, and we finally won that. Right? Now, and the other piece that happened in Massachusetts was when the court ruled, they said that they would give us 6 months to adjust to the fact that we were going to have same-sex marriage. Mm-hmm. So we knew at some point that the marriages were going to start. So we were not in a situation that people were in, say, Utah right now. So what happened was that we knew in 6 months marriages would start. The court did not, the opposition tried to get the court to change that. They refused to do it. And so at the same time that they were working to get the Constitution changed, people were getting married. Right? But there was always this thing hovering over them, and we had to end the movement to change the Constitution. And we did that, and we were able to do that.
Now, many people that I speak with, when they hear that I openly support it and believe, and I would equate it to civil rights, and they would say many African Americans do not support. And I couldn't bring myself to being able to explain to them that, in my opinion, what I've experienced in life, it is civil rights when you're being denied rights that are afforded to you under the Constitution. What marriages bring, right? Sharing your, when you pass, just as an example, the government or someone else gets your monies or the monies that you've gotten through hard work, but your partner is nowhere, can't get it, and not involved. That's just one thing. How did Massachusetts deal with that? Was it, what did they do to make sure that the people, the partners, or the husband or the wife would get it? Was there required to write it in, or was it?
Well, one of the interesting things is, of course, that before before we started asking for marriage, one of the things we realized is that people, as same-sex couples who were living together, who were committed to a lifelong relationship, were being discriminated against in the ways that you spoke of, like in quite gross ways. Like, you go to the hospital and you say, I want my partner just is in the hospital. I want to see my partner. Most hospitals, the ICUs only allow families to visit.
Right.
Right. So you come and you say, and they say, well, what's your relationship? And then, what is your relationship? You know, and so you can't visit unless the hospital, individual hospital, changes its policy. Right? So why should that be? If you were married, that question wouldn't come up at all. No one would ask that question. And so we had what was called civil unions in a lot of states, which was essentially to list all of the rights that married people have and say that these couples could have them. But there were lists, right? And so we said, wait a minute. If we give them all those rights, what's the difference between that and marriage?
And that was on a civil union.
That's right. And so we said, wait a minute. Let's stop fiddling around with civil unions, and let's just talk about what the fundamental problem here is. And the fundamental problem is people are being discriminated in getting married. Now, lots of people, I mean, marriage is a complicated institution. And it has lots of different meanings. But we were only concerned about one of its meanings. And our concern was the civil nature of marriage. The nature of marriage that is civil, that the government establishes. So the fact is, if you want to get married, right, you, of course, any two people can get together and say they're married, right? But if you want to get married and have the rights that married people have, you have to have that be a marriage that you get a license for, right, and gets approved by some government. Some government is going to approve that. And so we said that was the marriage we're talking about. We're talking about civil marriage. And in any civil institution, people should not be discriminated against. We have lots of civil institutions, right? And people should not be discriminated against in those civil institutions. And marriage is one of those. And so in that sense, it is absolutely a civil right. Right? It is the right to full participation in a civil institution. And that was the argument that we made. We had to keep making that argument, of course, over and over again to people to make that distinction. What we made it clear that if you felt that you wanted to have a religious wedding, a religious marriage, that is in addition to your civil marriage. And so if you are a religious institution, you can say, I don't want to marry those people. Any religious institution in this country can say, I don't want to marry those people.
Right.
And they get that because they have a right as a religious institution. But the government doesn't have that right. The government can't say that.
Right.
You see, so if I go to a church and they say, we won't marry you because of whatever reason, and I say, okay, but I want to get married, and I go to City Hall, they can't say we're not going to marry you for that reason.
Right, and
you see, so that's the difference.
Yeah, that was the difference.
And I tell people, I said, you know, so but you got to understand, this is the other part of the civil thing. You know, you get a tax break,
right?
You know, all of that kind of stuff.
Right.
The church doesn't give you that tax break.
Right.
The government gives you that tax break. The government can decide. The government can decide how they are going to interpret their civil right around this civil institution.
Right. Equal to all citizens.
That's right. So I only got, and so I had no problem in with the religious organizations in Massachusetts who were opposed to this, as long as they understood that they did not have the authority to determine what the civil law is going to be. And we do not have, and that's why, remember, in the First Amendment, it says that we'll do nothing to stop you from practicing your religion.
Right.
But it also says we will have no established church. That's
the
all
government
in it too.
Not
the
have
government
will
not
establish.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. So that and those are the those, you know. So churches can do anything they want to do. They can influence government as much as they want to, but they cannot pass the law for the government.
And then I always, in a humorous saying, wait, just simply say, if they don't want you, don't go there.
Right?
That's just
but
fine.
There were people, and we had black church people in Massachusetts, like we've had in other states when this issue comes up, who say that it's not a civil right because it doesn't relate to black people only.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to say, wait a minute.
Yeah.
I know that most of the big civil rights issues in our lifetime have related to race, but that's not the only definition of civil rights.
Tell the gypsies in Europe.
That's not the only definition.
I was going to say that the 1964 Civil Rights Act, it talks about handicapped people, not just black, handicapped.
Yeah. Well, anyway, we're going to take a break. My guess is, and I'm happy to have him, Massachusetts State Representative Byron Rushing and Marsha Joyner. You know that the Marsha, the Martin Luther King, I'm about to call it
they're
the Marsha.
They're going to be calling that next year.
the parade is going to take place on Monday.
Monday.
Tomorrow, 9 o'clock. At Magic Island, and then there will be a rally at the...
At the end of the parade. Now, the streets will begin to close at 8:30, so anybody that's going anywhere, remember that.
Well, we'll be right back. This is a Carol Cox Show, and you know that you can pick it up live stream at carolcox.com.
Ago, things ain't always black and white. Just like you can't judge a book
by the cover. We all got to be careful how we treat one another. Skin deep. Skin deep. Underneath. We all the same. We all the same thing. We all are the same.
Stay tuned for the second half of the Carol Cox Show right after the news on KWAI Honolulu, K101.
This is KWAI Honolulu, 1080 on the AM dial.
Questions or comments for Carol, our number here is 524-1080, 524-1080. And now, here's Carol.
All righty, good morning and welcome back to the Carol Cox Show. Again, I'm having a fun time here and really appreciate, I'm enjoying this all with Massachusetts State Representative Byron Rushing, who's here visiting, and some very interesting and good work he's done for the people, and clearly he continues to do it. And then I have Marcia Joyner, who is here with us also. And don't forget the Martin Luther King Parade. And by the way, Mr. Rushing and his wife, Frida Garcia, is the Grand Marshals. So anyway, tomorrow, 9 o'clock, if you'd like to come down, Marcia, give a little quick instruction. So,
okay. The parade begins at Magic Island at 9 a.m. and proceeds through Waikiki to Kapi'olani Park. Now, please be advised, all the streets in Waikiki will be closed at 8:30. Don't even dream of coming down and trying to drive. My suggestion is before 8:30 that you try to get into Waikiki, and the best way would be through the backside across Diamond Head to come in that way and along the Alawai, but all the side streets will be closed. And the parking lot at the Kapi'olani Park is all chewed up. So again, please start looking for parking other places. And you're more than welcome, if you haven't paid your fee and you want to walk in the parade, show up with your checkbook and we'll take you.
It's all about the mighty dollar.
Well, no, really, that's the only way.
You have expenses.
Yeah,
the
you have coverage.
Expenses are unbelievable.
Yeah, just to put on the parade.
Just, oh, gosh, yes.
Unfortunately, the city, this is Rod Tam, unfortunately, from my past experience as a city councilman, it's a shame that the city and county of Honolulu charges for the parade.
Well, no, they don't charge us. We are a First Amendment parade.
Oh, fair.
So we're different, but we still have expenses. Mm-hmm. All of the cones that cone off all the streets,
mm-hmm.
and the parking cones, and all of the little things that it takes to pull this off, the expenses are unbelievable.
And your organization has to bear that cost?
And none of us get paid. Hmm. Yes, and we, yeah.
Well. Well, there should be legislation, especially when there are parades such as this, but the government can't dedicate money to these causes. But anyway,
That's different. But we are what the court calls a first. The court says the state, yeah. the city has to do
provide
certain things.
The opportunity. But, well, anyway, guys, welcome back. And as Rod introduced himself, Rod Tam, and we've been talking about affordable housing and what have you. And I invited Rod back because we did get answers back to some of those questions, and we're going to co-mingle, I should say, in a positive sense, what we found in the response from HUD. And Mr. Rushing, or Representative Rushing here, he's been active in the homeless issue, and I first want to ask him, did they see a reduction in what they did, and if he could explain again, he alluded to some of it. But I would just like to see, is it possible that we're just struggling with something that's uncontrollable here in this state, the issue of homelessness, or what did they do for success? So, if you could, please.
I'm not sure what the history is around homelessness in Hawaii, but mm-hmm. of course in Massachusetts, it was that when you know some of us were growing up. I don't mm-hmm. want to give that out of everybody's age. When some of us were growing up, we didn't know homelessness. I mean, there was it'd be a very weird thing. But you mean one or two people who that you'd see that just didn't seem to have a place to live. There was enough housing available in mm-hmm. Boston. We had almost a whole neighborhood that was made up of rooming houses. And that's where most of, and just had all these people who mostly single men who lived in these rooming houses,
mm-hmm.
and that we lost because of gentrification. That we lost because the real estate market mm-hmm. just significantly changed, and of course there was more. If you could make more money on those buildings if you made them if you made them into apartments and back into apartments if you sold them as condos, mm-hmm. And that meant that all of those people had to find some other place to live, and we weren't supplying that housing. And then and then the other thing that happened in the 1960s that had repercussions that went on for years and years and years was how we changed the way we were treating the mentally ill. And in the 60s, most mentally ill people were institutionalized, and we had none of the drugs that were available to keep, to sort of give them the appearance mm-hmm. of being calm,
mm-hmm.
right? And when those drugs were invented, people thought that we could reintegrate these mentally ill people mm-hmm. into our communities. Because they were not acting out in the many violent ways that they were before these drugs were available, mm-hmm. and so we had what people now call deinstitutionalization, and when they say that, they're talking about the deinstitutionalization of these large mental hospitals, and in both of these cases where you had these shifts that were obvious that were going on, we did not have the leadership to provide for the housing that those people needed in our communities. Mm-hmm. And what we are seeing now, certainly in Massachusetts and in most of the big cities in the mainland, what we are seeing is the results of all of that, of not producing enough of that housing for this growing population of poor people. Now, in percentage-wise, there are less poor people in the United States than there were 30, 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. But in terms of actual numbers, there are actually more, mm-hmm. right? Because the population is growing. And we have to have housing for that population. We have to have housing that population can afford. And this gets to another interesting civil right, right? Mm-hmm. Is that do we have economic civil rights? Are there sort of bare minimums? Are there floors that we should guarantee to everybody because they are a human being? Mm-hmm. And I believe that that's true. Then your economic policy has to be a policy that includes an investment in the floor, that includes an investment for the poor, for no matter how they got poor. And so not only do I think we should be doing this work because we should have that we should have housing for all of these human beings, that mm-hmm. people should not have to live on the streets, mm-hmm. right? But we should also be doing it because I believe it's a right. Mm-hmm. I think, though, it's not a defined right. It should be. If I had the choice, if I had the opportunity to vote for having an amendment to make housing a human right, I would vote for that. But I think we have to have a policy that operates that way.
Good morning, caller. You have a comment, a question?
Yes, I'm calling. I'm homeless. I had a place to live. The police here, on the lie of a landlord, dragged me out into the state of homelessness and denied me my ability to get my property back. They beat on me. Charged me with crimes, and I had to spend well over a year defending my name against the lies of those dressed as police. I've been trying to get back home, and I'm stuck here on this island. I'm an artist. I've been trained in all sorts of industry jobs. I'm very hireable, but because of what the police did, I can't get a job. They charged me with assault. They charged me with harassment. One charge was dismissed because the police did not show up for the case, the other assault case. I won on state's evidence with a lovely, lovely public defender named Craig Jerome. My name is Denise N. David, and I want to go home. Mm-hmm.
Well, clearly you have access to a phone. You can give me your private information or contact information and call 782-6627, and we can talk further, but there are no promises, but maybe we can assist and see what it is, contact some people that may be able to help you.
Thank you.
Okay, and send a 782-6627. If you have email, carol@carolcox.com.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I think that, this is a person we need to listen to. Mm-hmm. And what I would be, my response, if I was home in Massachusetts, if this is the kind of call I got in my office, was actually pretty much what you just did. Mm-hmm. I would, I would have that person come in, and we have to go through the details because, you know, there are lots of pieces of the story. Mm-hmm. But representation, right, legal representation is very important when right. we're talking, for everyone who is in a position like this. And that's mm-hmm. that's why, on the other hand, we have to make sure we are funding right. the groups of lawyers who are doing this work in our communities.
Now, you are a state representative.
I am a state representative.
So there are two different entities. The city, does the city adopt and work well with your, or are they, do they work separate to be successful, or?
We try to work together as much as possible. Mm-hmm. Of course, we Boston has, you know, Massachusetts is one of those interesting states in the United States where their most populous city is their capital. Mm-hmm. So you know, so I can and I guess that's true here in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. But we're not, there are not many states like us, you know.
Right.
Most states, it's a little tiny town in some, you know, go to New York State. I don't want to talk to all the, I don't have all the New Yorkers called. Don't let them all call back. But, you know, where's the capital of New York? It's in Albany, you know. It's
right.
And so what that does mean, that you should have better cooperation.
Right.
I think I've always thought that that's one of the reasons why we mm-hmm. have as good cooperation as we do. Well, you know, it's different, but we try to cooperate as much as possible.
And you do obtain HUD money through from the state programs, or the
so HUD? HUD money comes comes both to the state and to the cities directly.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And in your case, in the state wise, the same rules apply for city in the use of and receipt of.
That's right.
HUD
money. One of the things about, of course, all the money that comes from the federal government, for us, it is a real problem because we think we should be getting more mm-hmm. of that money. And one of the things that has slowed down the amount of housing that we've been able to produce is that we've not been able to get enough money from the federal government for Section 8s and other kinds of programs that do that pay for subsidized housing. And so we have had to raise money from our state funds mm-hmm. and contribute to make up the gap that we are seeing that's growing every year between how much the feds used to give and what they're giving now.
Now, the monies that the feds gave you as a state, have you ever found yourself not able to use this money in a timely fashion, or have you ever been penalized, your agents, your state government?
It's very rare. Every once in a while that happens. It's very rare. But we do have in Massachusetts a very important group of people that you need to do to keep track of this kind of stuff, and that's the advocates. The advocates have to stay on this, uh-huh. on this whole issue of making sure that the money that does come in and the money that is appropriated is used for those purposes.
And as far as transparency, when does Massachusetts, federal law requires cities and states recipients of this money to post their spending and the use of it annually. Do you folks there in Massachusetts?
Depending on the governmental entity, mm-hmm. you have different levels of transparency.
Right.
So the state is very transparent. Although there are advocates who think that we're not transparent enough, and they point to other states that they think they do a better job of getting all of those figures, detailed figures on the web and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that we're very conscious of
mm-hmm.
and are working toward. And then it depends on the city
mm-hmm.
on how good they are. It is an important aspect of government,
mm-hmm.
and you should be able to go online and find out where all the money went.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's something. I have to say, though, that as an individual legislator, I really depend a lot on advocates to be doing this work.
Mm-hmm.
I know probably we should be doing all of it.
You can't physically do it all.
But that's right. And we should probably have an office that's doing more of this.
Mm-hmm.
But I listen to those advocates when they come and say, "Hey, mm-hmm. we think that money wasn't spent, or we're not sure what happened to it."
Mm-hmm.
Generally, it is not a problem in mm-hmm. Massachusetts. But I do want to make sure that you understand that one of the reasons why it's not a problem is because of those activists.
Right. Well, I want to make sure the listeners hear this clear. Anyone else that may be sensitive about this topic. That I'm just enjoying the fact that he's present, Mr. Rushing is present, to give us some kind of examples, or because Rod and I are going to be complaining about a lot of this, but what we're complaining about, are we being irrational or unreasonable? So that's why I was asking you some of those questions. And I want to share with the listeners out there, we did get a response back to some of the questions that I had asked
of HUD. And the first question was, has the mayor formally consulted with the United States Housing and Urban Development on the sale of the city's affordable housing? This is HUD's response. For over 8 years, the city has off and on discussed the city affordable housing sale with HUD. In regards to the current issue being reported in the media related to the buyer and financing issue, the city has not discussed and should be detailed in its plans with HUD. And I had also asked the money. How much money did the city receive from HUD in July 2012? Their response, HUD's response was, city was allocated $7,530,357 in 2012 for CDBG grants. To date, they only spent $3.5 million of that $7.5 million, so to speak. Then I asked the same question for 2013. HUD's response was the city was allocated $7 million for this year, $817,498. Of that amount, to date, none of those funds have been spent. Now, there's much more. I don't know if I'm being unreasonable or don't know all the factors, but if you're looking for money and we're seeing an increased population of homelessness and what have you, why would anyone sit on $13 million that could be used to fight or stamp out or at least improve the lives of the homeless, right?
Well, that's a big question there, and I thank you very much for the opportunity, Carol. You know, I don't know, quite frankly. When I was in the city, it was better management of money. You begin to wonder, what's the accountability of our city government now? And like our previous guest speaker was saying, there's no joint partnership between government and the nonprofit dedicated agencies out there to help the homeless and or those in need of affordable rental housing. You know, I've talked to the homeless people out there on the streets, and like our guest said, the key here to learn about what's happening is to talk to the people rather than be shut down in your office behind a desk and have people come to see you, which is what's happening here in the state of Hawaii, especially in the city county of Honolulu. And many of those social agencies or government officials are staying behind the desk rather than talking to people and find out what are the real problems. And by the way, I want to make a clear definition in terms of what a homeless person is. And a homeless person consists of those who live on the streets and live in off of family and friends because they can't afford rent, even if it's a low-cost, affordable housing. And those living in homeless shelters also, too.
Well, you know, when I was working, this is Marcia, and as you know, I worked for Rod, and one of the families we met, they had had a home, car, children, everything, but the house burned down, and they didn't have the insurance to replace the house. So they were homeless. Not that they didn't have a job, not that they didn't have everything. They didn't have mental illness. They didn't want to live on the street. No drug problems. But they could not have them. They did not have the money in today's market to get a new house. They just, new houses. And if you notice last week, the houses over $2 million were on the market for less than a month. And there's nothing that you can afford.
And by the way, our cost of living here is very high. There are many unemployed. Contrary to our Governor Abercrombie, he's saying that the economy is good. It's not good at all.
It depends on who you are, how good it is.
Let me clarify in terms of what is gross middle income. For a person, two in a family, you have to make at least $63,000. Who makes $63,000 in a year, basically? For a family of four, like my do, you have to make $85,190. And if you're low income, which is 80% of the median, you have to make $68,152.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If you're very low, it's $42,595. Now, minimum wage itself doesn't give you that much money. And quite frankly, a lot of our people are working minimum wage. By the way, there's a lot of jobs out there in the market in Hawaii. but it's all minimum pay. Right? So basically, who can afford to even rent a low-income affordable housing? Government has to, what government needs to do here is to redefine our brackets for low-income housing rather than take the national standards, basically. We have a different source of incomes here, and our wages are much lower. Opportunities are not less, quite frankly. So let's reinvent in terms of what is our affordable income brackets level here.
Well, listen, now my question, of course, is to both of you. Since the majority of people working for minimum wage are women, why don't we look at this as a discriminatory practice? Because that's where the minimum wage is, with women. Women that are single parents, women are doing most of those jobs. And we don't look at that. You don't offer a man $7 an hour, but they have no problem offering women $7 an hour. And even to where we are now with the state, Senator, he has proposed $10.10, without the tip credit. So that's a step forward, but it's not good enough.
Mm-hmm. Marsha, you're right. In terms of the low-income earners, winners here in Hawaii are mostly women. And a lot of them are single parents and with two to three kids or four kids, basically. Unfortunately, they don't even have child alimony at this time. So I've seen a lot of those women having to live with their parents or some other family in order to survive. And they can't even afford milk. Half a gallon of milk is $5 here in Hawaii. It's very difficult.
Now, looking at this HUD report that HUD shared with us, in assessing cities' performance, HUD relied primarily upon the city's Program 12 Consolidated Annual Performance and Evaluation Report, CAPER. Technical assistance, on-site monitoring, communication of the city federal program staff. During this period, the city generally met the intent of the emergency shelter grant, housing opportunities for persons with AIDS, HOPWA, that's an acronym, mm-hmm. programs, and was successful in the management of the ESG and HOPWA programs. However, HUD has serious concerns regarding the city's implementation of its Community Development Block Grant, or CDB, and Home Investment Partnership programs and its ongoing capacity to manage the programs. Now, this isn't the first report that HUD has found them to be delinquent, deficient, and what have you. So my question is, why is HUD not pulling all resources out to bring them into compliance, or we run the risk of losing the money? But overall, the city has had capacity issues with its management of its CDB and home programs as follows. Since program year 2008 now, the city has failed the CDB timeliness test, and that's what we asked for last week in the questions we had asked. They didn't get back to us. And by the way, Mayor Caldwell has yet to respond to our questions, so I guess he think I'm homeless and I don't have an address that he can mail to. Maybe that would be the explanation. I can't come to terms with that. But on May 2nd, 2013, oh, and by the way, this is the same mayor that he's doing fine. He has a historical house and doesn't have to pay taxes on and all of that, isn't it? Where's the shame? We've lost shame in ourselves today to manage people's affairs and to be fair and civil-minded. I would be embarrassed to be associated with this as a mayor or as a human being. I don't know about you, Rod.
Well, let me say this. From my experience of 32 years in public service, from neighborhood board to House representative to senator and to city council, there's a lot of talk among elected officials. But in terms of due respect to them, there's no follow-up in terms of actual working on the problem of those in need of lower-cost, affordable housing, even rentals. Not buying. I'm talking about rent. I'm talking about rental units. So basically, you know, it's, in this case, HUD is not doing its accountability. They got to go after the city.
Good morning, caller. You have a comment or question?
Yes. I was calling to
One, thank you, panel, for your comments and your thoughts. I think this has sorely been needed in this state and many others. I noticed that a vast majority of those that are homeless are of a darker hue. Mm-hmm. I'm a woman of color. I'm of African descent. I notice these things. But I do notice that quite a number of those who are homeless are of a darker hue. Mm-hmm. Is that coincidence or is that
mm-hmm.
something that, I just find it interesting that with the anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, that these things would still be prevalent in our society, especially Hawaii. The main reason why I came here was because I thought it was a minority-majority state and that there would be much more love and openness. There was when I first got here 20 years ago, but I see that diminishing. And that gives me worry for the state.
Okay.
I came here with open arms, and I see it decaying. And I really believe it's the,
mm-hmm.
the type of politicians and those appointed leaders that are in office.
Right. Okay.
This wasn't Hawaii 20 years ago.
All righty, Carla. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Can I make a comment about that?
Yes, ma'am.
So many people, I think, don't know their history and don't understand what not just you, but the Hawaiians have gone through.
Oh, yes.
And so now we see a resurgence of this, what you're talking about, as people move in from other places. And you commented our host here commented about building walls.
Yes.
And this whole new, segregating themselves, I guess.
Gentrification
And so we do see that local people of all colors are being pushed into the background. And you're right. I mean, I'm agreeing with you.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing to watch this happen.
Is it?
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, Jessica.
To move back to Martin Luther King, of course, one of the things I read on my way here was a speech that I'd never read before,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, was when he was invited to address your state legislature right after Hawaii became a state. I think it might have been in
1959.
Mm-hmm. And one of the first paragraphs in that speech is commenting on the racial variety that exists in Hawaii and how Hawaii should be a model for the country. He says that. And so it's very interesting how, again, when you hear these words from Martin Luther King, think about what, if you are taking him seriously, if you think he is prophetic, what do you do with these words, and what is this as a challenge to Hawaii?
Well, I think that African Americans and Hawaiians share a lot in common, and that is the colonialistic behavior. What started this was people taking over, overpowering other people. In our case, as African Americans, we were enslaved. Though they freed us, there were very few measures to ensure that we would be compensated so that we would make a fair and equitable transition. So on the opposite end of that, the Hawaiians, they were taken by gunpoint and were told, you are the host culture, and so we'll work it, and so did many others. Martin Luther King and others were fascinated
mm-hmm.
about the makeup, the melting pot image. But the reality is all of this is done on the backs and shoulders in the heart of the Hawaiian people, which was never addressed. It was wrongfully taken from them. So this thing is inevitable.
the racism toward the Hawaiian people, the homelessness and the population that we have, I believe it's directly connected in the African American. Our demise, as our current set, is related to slavery and never being fairly given the opportunity. And I know this doesn't set well with many of you out there, but I don't care, you see. That's why we call it the Carol Cox Show. it's my thoughts, and unless we, it's back to that bicycle scenario. You took my bicycle, I tell you about it, I want it back, you apologize for taking it, but you keep it. So nothing ever is addressed. So the Hawaiian people, nothing is really being addressed, and by now, it's taken by gunpoint, and it's still being kept by gunpoint, because if you really speak out too much as a Hawaiian or if an African American, eventually you find yourself behind bars, because that's the system. So nothing's changed. So when we see the gentrification, that is just one element or aspect of this thing evolving, this whole process evolving, building fences around. They say, for example, this is a culture that sustains itself picking berries and, you know, practicing the culture and incorporating all of that sustainability and subsistence living. Well, you can't go to the beaches and fish anymore, pretty much, because most of that's privatized, or you gain access to it is difficult. You can't go to the mountains in certain areas because the state has a great bit amount of it taken. Private lands are taking it and farming it. So really, we're telling a big lie. We're help carrying this big lie. This is not a melting pot. It's more of maybe an ash pot, because nothing is to be gotten out of it. It's evolving, and we see it. This whole process, where once when you move in and build a house for $600,000 or $6 million, the property next to it now goes up in taxes value. So how does a native Hawaiian compete with that when he's on a fixed income or no income, but he's making a living, eking out a living, subsistence? And then in turn, what happens? He now is faced with a tax bill. Got to sell or lose it.
And
is it
go ahead.
The tax situation, the property tax situation that you're talking about, of course, is one of the major ongoing problems of gentrification on the mainland, and you see it all the time. And people have tried to figure out ways of having the system work that's fair for the people who are there when richer people move in. I mean, as I tell people, you know, I mean, rich people have civil rights too. I have no objection to rich people living near poor people, right? But the fact of their living near poor people should not be detrimental to the poor people.
Right, impeding their rights.
That's right. So if they come and we do, and that means that we have to come up with a different system for doing property tax. And this is something that has there's lots of pushback. Obviously, I mean, there's pushback from municipal governments, because one of the things, of course, is that you know the tendency is that you want to get more tax money. Right, and so we have to talk about how are we fair to everyone in the community, right? And then also we have to then take a bigger look and that gets to the question of, is property tax the fairest way to do the taxation? Should the major funds for cities come from property tax versus other forms of taxation?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I would submit this, that if anybody knows best, it's you, Boston Tea Party.
Now, you have to understand, when we say the Tea Party, we mean the real Tea Party.
The real Tea Party.
We celebrate every year. That's right. So next time we're in Boston in December, you can come to the real celebration of the real
Boston
Tea
Party. So if anybody want to talk about tax,
that's right.
You know, if I may, since we had a little talk about property tax, you talk about and civil rights, property tax are very unfair to the senior citizens. And basically the burden of the property tax is mostly on the senior citizens, because 60% of your property owners here are residential or senior citizens.
I see.
Now, so What it is they need to adjust it whereby stabilizing the property tax on senior citizens rather than be the market price.
Right.
Yeah, well, our next door neighbor, we've been in the place for 30 years. Our next door neighbor moves in, pays $750,000 for this little piece of house here. Now, all of a sudden, because I'm 76, my husband's 83, all of a sudden, our tax bill, because our next door neighbor can afford $750,000 house.
Right. Caller, good morning. Thank you for calling. You have a comment, a question?
Good morning.
Yes, good morning.
Yes, there's a couple of things I want to mention. Martin Luther King, his first name is Martin Luther.
Mm-hmm.
What effect does that have, or did that have, on his life? Secondly, I noticed in the film that when they were walking on the bridge, Martin Luther King and a number of his followers had leis on them. Anybody have any comment on what that was about or where it came from?
Oh, yes. Well, you probably know the story better than I do, Marcia, but of course they were given to them by Hawaiians who came to the march. So activists.
Again, you had civil rights supporters in Hawaii that came to the march, and then they brought those leis with them, which they gave to all the leaders on the march. So, of course, this was 1963, the bridge was 64.
65.
I'm sorry. That's right. But it was still close enough to, when Martin Luther King had been here.
They brought the lei, and because there were people from Hawaii that went for summer of 64.
Right. That's right.
And you'll love this little story.
Yeah.
We got time? Okay. The one guy that went to summer of 64, it was in Mississippi. It was horrible. It was just awful. And they were killing people. And he was Chinese, but he's from Hawaii.
Right.
And so what happened is the young white kids would come down from the north, and their families would send checks. Well, the banks wouldn't cash their checks. So what happened is that Carl becomes the banker because he's Chinese. So they figured, oh, he must have a Chinese laundry or a Chinese restaurant. So he would cash the checks for them. So right. the banks would allow him, when in fact he was an activist. But he was from Hawaii. Right. Chinese.
Anybody out there that have a difficult time, if you're not African American, you have a difficult time understanding the racism in America and the history of racism and who suffered from it. If you have a tough time of reading African American history, just pick up a book and read the Chinese American history. If you want to, massacres, denial, even building the railroad across connecting the east to the west, after they were successful in building it, they wouldn't even give the Chinese workers a ride on the train to get home.
Right.
And so, but and that's just minor. Hold on. So this is the day, as you said earlier, about Dr. Martin Luther King and being there. We all need to celebrate it because when you look at the Chinese culture and what happened and how they were, only males were allowed to come here, and all of those things.
Right.
I mean, I'm embarrassed to complain about what happened to me when I really know the history of the Chinese American and many other Asian Americans.
And we cannot do any of this work into the future in any progressive way, in any way where we're really helping, where we're figuring out ways to help everybody if we don't do the history.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't do the history, none of this is going to make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard, history. So I understand why it's difficult for a lot of people to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard history, and we need to know those of us who are the descendants of that extreme oppression need to know the histories of each other.
Right. If we intend to go forward.
That's right. And so in that sense, when we talk about black history, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
We need to do that. But we also need to make sure that all of our children are learning the other histories also. Because there is a history of the United States, mm-hmm. and it's very difficult for us to tell that history all together.
And now, I do apologize. I would also remind us about the Native American,
of course.
Oh.
And we're and so when someone shares with me that they can't accept the Martin Luther King birthday, whatever it is, whoever he is, what it stands for is to say, let none of this violence against any one people ever occur again. That is that we must collectively work together.
Wait,
that is
correct. But you know, the way we got this holiday here in Hawaii was only because of all the different ethnic groups that came together to make it happen. It mm-hmm. wasn't just a handful of African Americans. It was all the different cultures that mm-hmm. came together that made it happen.
With that, if I may add, I was a state representative at that time when we made Martin Luther King Day a celebration here. And the reason is because we embraced the multiculture. And we knew that it was fading away. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of prejudice was coming here from the mainland, if I may. Mm-hmm. And no offense to the mainland people who come here to live, it's great. But then you are bringing your prejudice here. Right. So we had to reestablish.
Caller, good morning. You have a comment or question?
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. The book, A People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn, is exactly what you are talking about. Very apropos. And once again, thank you so much for your program, the people you invite, and for me, a Caucasian, it is very, very helpful, educational, and thank you so very much for all of us. Aloha.
Aloha. Aloha. Thank you.
And I have to say, of course, I knew Howard Zinn, and of course, Howard Zinn was at Boston University.
Mm-hmm. Right. And anybody that was part of the civil rights movement knew Howard Zinn.
Right. He wrote a history of SNCC before he wrote the history of the United States.
Yeah. We need civil rights here activists. And if I may, when I was a councilman, I went to the mainland, and this was years of 2000. And believe me, being Chinese, I never received so much prejudice in my life and discrimination. And they even thought I was Chicano.
Yeah,
because I have a mustache and it always dark complexion.
Dark hair, right? Well, you know, when we came to Hawaii in 1946 with Uncle Sam, my mother and I could not stay at the Royal Hawaiian Hotel, even though we were military, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And, well, you know, there were certain places on the island that Chinese couldn't live. But my mother was just horrified that when we got here, even this was segregated.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's segregated because the reality is it's America still has certain factions that are racist. And we all of us, never should ever become so comfortable in our ways if we get a good job and get set. Just remember, came to you hard working, but it can go easy in a community where there's racism allowed and discrimination permitted.
And every time we see it, we got to name it.
Name it, not...
It's hard. It's hard. After a while, it gets difficult. And you want to say, oh, the little things, I'll let that slide. You have to name them.
Claim it and name it. But here's... and I'm going to let you guys finish this up. In this HUD report, the city has 6 CDB-funded activities that are slow-moving. These activities include Kulana Malama Eva Villages, Area H, Habitat for Humanity's Leeward Housing Development Corporation, Honolulu Fire Department, land acquisition for Haulu Special Olympics, Kapolei Complex, Nanakuli Housing, Hawaiian Homestead Community Association for the Cope Center, Honolulu Fire Department, the area of Kuakini, Honolulu Fire Department engine for Parva, and Catholic Charity Services Center renovation. The city should continue to closely monitor these activities, ensure that they progress in a timelier manner. Failure to complete these activities in a timelier manner may result in repayment of the funds. Now, I mentioned that to just simply say, if you want to know what racism is to install a system called HUD, hand it money, and it's supposed to administer these monies to stamp out these vile acts of discrimination. And it sits here and plays around with it in a kind way. And if I get a chance, I'll read you the closing statement.
Would you go back and read that list and tell your listeners where those places are? Nanakuli?
Mm-hmm.
Haula?
Yeah.
That in itself is discriminatory, that you let those places languish.
Well, they're taking this one piece of property in Haula for a fire department from a citizen on an eminent domain or something, condemnation, but yet the federal government is giving monies. So I have to say, I won't define it.
But if you just read that list again.
I won't characterize it as racism.
Why
but,
not?
But the impacts are the
Why
same.
Not?
Go ahead, and we got about five more minutes.
Okay.
You know the problem here, Carol, is that when the city applies for these monies from the federal government, because it's called community block grant funds, and they don't have to show any action plans, basically. All they do is name it, and then when they get the money, then they have to show the action plans to carry it out. And there's no fault to you in terms of accountability. So not only the city is at fault, HUD is at fault, too.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, I hate to say, but that's administration fault, being from the mayor, Kirk Caldwell, and from the administration of the federal.
He touted his people that he appointed as being the top of the top.
You know what, also, too, if I learn here, I may be open about it in government. This is where I get into trouble, quite frankly. A lot of this grant money goes to nonprofit organizations or even profit organizations, and basically a lot of it goes to high pay salaries.
Right.
Without any terms of real basic needs being addressed.
How can the mayor allow $13 million to be just laying around when we have projects and we have people on the streets and all of these projects are targeted to address homelessness and making lives better for people? How can... I'm sorry, I don't...
No, you're right. You're right.
I want to just jump in here, Carol, if I may. I want to say that I'm a visitor, and I've been invited on this show to talk about Martin Luther King and Martin Luther King holiday. And let me tell you, as an observer, Martin Luther King is smiling.
Yeah.
You see, because if we're going to celebrate Martin Luther King, we have to do the several things that we've been doing for the past few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
We have to remember our history. We have to place the civil rights movement exactly where it should be placed. And we have to talk about what we have to do next. Mm-hmm. And there's no way. I mean, Martin Luther King did not go many places and talk about what we had to do next without being controversial.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we're going to live up to the tradition, right, and the legacy of Martin Luther King, every time we talk about him, we should be ending with something that someone is going to consider controversial. So, Carol, I think you did a pretty good job of celebrating Martin Luther King in this past
year. Well, you know, that to take a quote from him, he says that our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter.
Right.
I mean, that's the bottom line.
Yeah.
You know.
In closing, if I may say this, that Dr. Martin Luther King was a great man, okay, and I'm Chinese, if I may, okay, so we all basically are discriminated when you think about if you're white. If you're non-white, okay, you're discriminated against this. And that's the nature of the United States, quite frankly, right? There's a lot of people out there that don't accept in terms of non-white people.
Yeah. Hold on 1 second here. Just call. Go ahead, real quick. You got a question?
Rosa Parks. There would have never been a Martin Luther King Jr. had there not been Rosa Parks.
Okay. Well, thank you.
And if I may conclude, since we talked about low-income affordable housing rental, what we need is an advocate group, quite frankly, in Hawaii. Mm. And I'm willing to start it. Mm-hmm. I'll give you my number.
Okay.
Give me a call. Rod Tam at 216-5454. 216-5454. I became an advocate because in punishment from government, they made me do community service. Guess where? In the Department of Housing. Because I fought for Kukui Gardens. And so they want to go after me. I stop them from demolishing it. And so they made me do community servicing in the Department of Housing. And I found out there's over 10,000 on applicants on the waiting list right now. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Rod. Okay, we're down to the last couple of seconds. Mr. Rushing, thank you for joining me. And real quick, do you have any parting words, right quick?
Yes, I really appreciate being invited to participate in the Martin Luther King events this year here in Honolulu, and I'm looking forward to the parade.
We have a bell ringing today at 5:30, Nagasaki Peace Bell, and I invite everybody, it's free, everybody to join us. Thank you.
Okay, I want to thank my guests, and we'll be talking about more of this. And go to carolcox.com, and all of these documents are posted, and we will get back with you next week. Have a happy parade, and I hope you all participate. And also, just remember the incarceration of the Japanese here in Hawaii. So the list goes on and on and on. So you and I can stop it and prevent it. Aloha.
This has been the Carol Cox Show, heard every Sundays at 9 a.m. on K108. Tune in again next week, Sunday at 9 a.m. to the Carol Cox Show on 1080 a.m. KWAI Honolulu.